when you're ready, let's start this game.
Welcome to Unstacked and Let's Unwind with best-selling historical fiction authors Janie Chang and Kate Quinn. Let's find out about their new release, The Phoenix Crown. Hey, this is Sarah from the Bay County Public Library.
Hey, this is Stephen from the Huntsville-Madison County Public Library.
And this is Janie Chang, and I'm calling in from the beautiful Sunshine Coast of British Columbia, Canada, and I write historical fiction. Most of them, they have Chinese settings and bring out aspects of Chinese history that maybe people don't know very much about. And I'm so excited about The Phoenix Crown because it actually takes place in the U.S. and in France.
And I'm Kate Quinn. I am the author of, at this point, I have to stop and think about how many books I have actually written, but all historical novels in a variety of settings, locations, and centuries. I jumped to the 20th century with my first World War novel, The Dallas Network, and have been in that area ever since. So The Phoenix Crown is a wonderful departure for me, headed to the Gilded Age of 1906 and the San Francisco earthquake. I am calling in from the rain and fog of the Pacific Northwest, so I envy anybody on anything that can be called a Sunshine Coast. But it's lovely to talk with everybody today.
And I am thrilled to have both of you guys on Unstacked. Can you introduce our listeners to your collaborative new historical fiction title, The Phoenix Crown?
The Phoenix Crown, when it really comes down to it, is a novel about two very unlikely women who would never even have probably met in the ordinary course of things. One is Gemma, a silver-voiced opera singer who is desperately looking for a career reboot when she arrives in San Francisco to take her place in the traveling Metropolitan Opera Chorus that is about to perform there. And one is Suling, a Chinatown seamstress and a terribly skilled embroideress as well, who is desperate to escape an arranged marriage and find out just where a certain lover of hers may have disappeared to. These two women are thrown together in the chaos and the fire and bloodshed of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, and nothing, least of all their own lives, is ever going to be the same after that.
I know that the San Francisco, the 1906, is just like packed with so much historical information, one city. And so what was the origin story for that? I know I saw a little bit the author's note from Kate on how that started.
It actually started with Kate giving me a call saying, you know, we've both been writing books set in world wars. Maybe we should do something lighter, like an earthquake and a devastating fire.
Yeah, we may not have thought that one through terribly well. But, you know, I've always been fascinated with the San Francisco earthquake. It really was one of the biggest natural disasters in U.S. history, perhaps not the biggest. And it has so much grist for story. And as soon as I was looking at this and thinking of, you know, how could you put a story into it, I thought, it really needs a Chinatown hero. And that's what it wants. The story wants that. And, you know, I thought, I wonder if Janie has ever been interested in writing anything along these lines. So I gave a call and I'm crossing my fingers thinking, does this interest you? Would this be a collaborative? This could be fun, right? And, you know, she went and looked at it and then thank God came back with a, yes, this interests me. And we really just started off with a very simple premise, which is going to be, I knew I wanted to write about an opera singer who was in this historic production of Carmen that was produced the night before the earthquake happened. And I just said, it's like, well, what do you want to do? Let's just take two very different women and throw them together and see what happens. And that's what we did.
And I think the big challenge, and also what made the plotting fun, is, you know, in those days, the Chinese were subjected to a lot of racism. So Chinese women in particular hardly ever left the safety of Chinatown. So how could we concoct a storyline where it was plausible for my heroine to actually wander outside the boundaries of Chinatown? And in a more interesting way, how could she get involved with Gemma? And how could the two of them end up being involved with the same man and sort of at the mercy of his goodwill, and then finding out that maybe he's not so goodwilled?
All of the character interactions are like one of my favorite parts of the novel.
Kind of leads into the question I wanted to go with here is both of your stories kind of involve strong heroines that defy stereotypes. So how do you approach crafting complex and empowered characters that may not have historically had power within a historical setting. And I guess we can start with Kate.
Well, it's something that has interested me in not just this book, but all my books, is the way in which women find ways to carve out these little circles and spheres of influence and independence when they live in times and places that do not want them to have it. Because women have always done this. And it is just a matter of finding out the ways in which they can. For Gemma, it was a matter of, you know, she is an opera singer. She's, you know, an independent artist, which is a job that has a lot of freedom to it, a lot of travel to it, but also a great deal of insecurity. So she has freedom, but she also has the insecurity of trying to carve her way in, you know, a profession as notoriously chancy as the stage. And that is the thing that, you know, consumes her, you know, time is like, how can I make a living? How can I make not just a living, but a success of myself? And that is, you know, something I find fascinating is how can she do these things? How can you find the ways, the shortcuts up the ladder? How can you carve out independence for yourself? Because that's something that all the women in this book want. And then, of course, you know, Janie and I talked about how Suling would achieve that as well.
And I think that it doesn't really matter which era you're writing your story in. You can always find a timeline where women are striving for agency and to find that sort of conflict between society and your own identity. The important thing and the challenging thing for novelists like Kate and I is to make sure that our female characters achieve that agency in a way that is plausible within the context of that era. You know, so if one of her characters or one of my characters is doing something that is outside the bounds of the norm, we need to show what is it in their past, in their upbringing, that has made their mindset so different from the norm. What is it that they're motivated by? What skills have they learned that allows them to be more empowered? We have to make it plausible, because otherwise their behavior is an anachronism.
And what we really did with this book, and I'm not sure entirely that we planned it that way, but it's certainly the way it emerged on us, is that we are, all of our women are gifted in some way. Suling is a tremendously talented embroideress, not just someone who does little piecework things to sell on the side as a cottage industry, though she does that too, but she's good enough to work at a couture house. It's just a matter of, can she get there? For Gemma, she has an incredible voice, but how is a voice enough to make you a star? You also need luck. And then we even have as our tertiary character, Alice Eastwood, who was a botanist and who was a real historical figure at the time. She was a head of botany at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. And she's a bit older than the other two, but she is a tremendously talented, self-taught scientist and botanist. And she stands as a little bit of a aspirational figure to the others because she is a woman who did carve out that career. She carved out that path. She had a talent. She had a passion. She followed it and she made a life for herself. And she was real. So it's not that these women didn't exist. They did. It's just a matter of finding them and seeing how did they carve out that life? And then, you know, our women want to do the same for themselves.
And the opera was a historical moment as well. And I liked how most of the characters were creatives, which does usually have this strong-willed, you have a little bit of like, I'm going to do this attitude when you are a creative in some sort. So it fits well as well, being the embroiderer, the painter, the singer.
I think it's one of those things, if you've ever been a creative, and I would count writers among here too, is that
yes.
You're already probably going to have a personality that a little bit wants to strike its own path, because if you've done anything creative and wanted to make a job out of it, I guarantee you, you've had somebody in your life telling you, wouldn't it be better to be a CPA? Wouldn't it be better to get something a little more reliable, dear? Don't you want a steadier paycheck? If you've already had a creative bent and that's how you want to make a living, you've already like a little bit had to break away from the norm.
And kind of touching on what Sarah had talked about just a moment ago here with the opera and it being, you know, a historical thing. How do you balance the historical accuracy that goes into a historical fiction kind of novel with the creative liberties that are required to craft an engaging story?
You know what? I like to say that there is the historical record, and then there's all the stuff that has not been recorded, and those are the gray areas, and that's where novelists get to play. We play in the gray areas. Having said that, both of us are really, really obsessed with making sure that the story is as accurate as possible. So, you know, like when we dug out a map of the burn area of San Francisco, we were just squealing because it meant that we could have our characters escaping and moving street by street down San Francisco and know that that was a safe path for them to take. We also have like extensive author's notes in the back, which tells you things like, well, we apologize for changing things a little bit here for the sake of the story. But, you know, there are so many different ways that people can regard history and play around with it. So, for example, Thornton, who is the millionaire in the piece, he was not a real person. But, you know, there were a lot of robber barons who owned mines and railroads, and they were ruthless. This was the Wild West. And even though they had reached a level in San Francisco where they could, you know, be a patron of the arts and support culture and put on a veneer of respectability, they were basically real bastards who had beat their way to the top, you know. And for Su Ling, there was no individual person like her. But, you know, I look at the influences around her, the fact that there were women being trafficked into Chinatown to work in brothels. Thank you, Chinese Exclusion Act. And the fact that there was a big missionary presence of trying to educate these girls. And the fact that she was of that first generation of Chinese actually born in the U.S. So she was being pulled in two directions by the rights and the ambitions of women that she saw, the white women that she interacted with, and then being pulled back into the quote-unquote safety of Chinatown. So you have all these factors that you get to play with. And it's actually a lot of fun trying to figure out how to work your way around the historical accuracy bits.
It's a kind of thing where in advance, we knew there were certain things that we wanted to include. Like I knew from the beginning that the famous production of Carmen that is performed the night before San Francisco, you know, goes up in fire and smoke is a moment in time that I wanted because everyone was there. It was so glittering. It was such a, you know, a shining highlight, social event of the season kind of thing where everyone is turning out in their diamonds and satins to be at this place. You know, if anyone who's anyone is there and Caruso is singing and it's, you know, a wonderful night. It's like the whole city is putting on its finest appearance right before it's about to go down. So I knew I wanted that because it was such a great, you know, set piece historical moment. And then it's a matter of crafting something fictional around that. So we sort of have had our list in advance of who are the people we want to include. Alice Eastwood was one, you know, with her botany experience and the fact that she had a fabulous rescue of all of her rare plant samples from her life's work when she basically escaped San Francisco with nothing more than those and the clothes on her back. And then The Night at the Opera was another. And we sort of earmarked what are the things that we want to include that are real landmark historical events or real landmark historical people. And then we craft our own fictional things around it. And that crafting is really a lot of fun. It's a lot of the fun part of getting to plot a book.
And you guys both were able to travel to San Francisco for a little preliminary research, correct?
Yes, and we had a great time.
What was that experience like? And did you have any favorite places or primary research discoveries on that journey? And I'll start with Kate.
Well, we really had a great fun going to San Francisco. We went and saw everything that we could. We went to libraries. We dug out original maps and photos to look at. So many helpful librarians and curators who helped us digging things out of the archives. We went to the California Academy of Sciences where Alice Eastwood worked and we saw her portrait on the wall and like squealed in unison. We dug through like her personal papers and saw like, okay, that she has a gap here in her European travels. We can definitely slot her to Paris in this point. We found these things. The fun part about it is not only the interesting things that we anticipated to find or illuminate, which we did, but was the things that we didn't expect, which sent the book on a totally different path. For example, one of those was when we went to San Francisco, the Guopé exhibit was in town. If you've ever seen or heard of Guopé, she's a Chinese couturier who specializes in fantastically embroidered creations that I guarantee you, you've seen on the red carpet of the Met Gala and the Oscars. And we just went to see the exhibit because it was there, not because it was relevant to the book. But by the time we walked out of that fantastic exhibit and those incredibly embroidered clothes, that's when we knew that Su Ling was not just going to be a talented seamstress, but a high-level embroideress who was fit to work in Paris. And that set the book on a completely new trajectory. And who would have known? We had no idea.
So exciting.
And then, you know, some of these things, some of the places we went to, they really just allowed us to absorb the details of what life must have been like. So one of the wonderful things that happened was we got to visit two great mansions in the Bay Area. One was Filoli House and Gardens, and the other one was Carolands. And they were incredible, not only because we got to see sort of the upstairs, downstairs aspect of it, you know, the gorgeous, gorgeous ballrooms with a stage at one end so we could put Gemma there, you know, singing beside the grand piano, but also things like the hidden staircases that the servants used to stay out of sight of the guests and so on. We had our moment of, wow, we didn't realize this was so, so terrific when at Carolands, we wandered into this beautiful tiled area with sinks and pots and pans hanging down and a mezzanine upstairs storing more china and silverware and glassware. And Kate goes, wow, this is a nice kitchen. And the curator said, it's the butler's pantry. So we were able to absorb all those details and, you know, put it back into our story.
I love a Gilded Era home. I mean, any that I've visited so far, they're so stunning. And I just love how it's also this merge of like antiquities and travel and collections and all into one space. It seems to be a little bit of a unifying.
Yes. And one of the things that really it helped to corroborate was that both these homes had chinoiserie, you know, Chinese influenced or Chinese antiques. So it really validated the part of our story where Thornton is a collector of Chinese antiquities because it was one of the ways that the wealthy people showed off how much good taste they had back in those days.
Kind of continuing on this, what goes into establishing the setting, but at the same time, making the city come alive as a character?
San Francisco has so much character. You know, how much more do we need to do?
I think the city really wrote itself. It's kind of felt like
the challenge actually was to try and pull back to the city the way it was in 1906. When it was trying to be the Paris of the West Coast. It really was. And that's why for a city of its size, they had, I don't know how many theaters and opera houses they already had. They had art galleries. They were all vying for being established as a cultural center. There was a fair amount of corruption too. I think the mayor of San Francisco at that time after the fire was indicted for something. And it was very cosmopolitan. It was a port city. So we have the opening scene where Gemma, you know, lands in San Francisco and all around her, she sees, you know, all types of different clothing, national costumes, people of different colors and races. And she's thinking, wow, I thought, you know, New York was diverse, but this is amazing.
Yeah, the thing about San Francisco is it kind of follows that boomtown mentality where it's became a big hub because of, you know, the gold rush, the railroads that brought a lot of money and a lot of people in very quickly. And then the first thing people do when they get money is then they want to elevate themselves. They want big houses. They want the kinds of clothes and furnishings that they can, and, you know, homes that they can have in New York on the East Coast. And then they start wanting to have places to go to show these things off. So you start bringing the culture in. And this is why, you know, like the Metropolitan Opera Company is traveling all the way to San Francisco, where they had, you know, a planned 2 weeks at, I think, 10 different operas that they were going to perform. And there were going to be people, you know, in many, many, many pounds of diamonds there to support them and to, you know, show off at that. What I tend to find as far as when it comes to bringing a setting to life is the details. And I was lucky enough that I found some great books. I mean, I found, you know, I think it was like a Goody Ladies book of 1906 that showed like in detail exactly what the clothing would look like and what would the materials be. There was a great book I found that just had a lot of fantastic little details about how the San Francisco accent at the time was kind of somewhere between Boston and New York, and how there were certain local speech isms, like they would always say south of Market Street was south of the slot because the slots of the tram cars. So you wouldn't say south of Market, you'd say south of the slot. Or like the fact that Pisco Punch was a very particular cocktail that was invented in San Francisco and lauded by all kinds of famous writers, which was it tasted like lemonade, but had a kick like vodka and made a gnat want to fight an elephant. Things like that. And I love the little details because the little things are the things that will bring a city to life. The thing is, unfortunately, is that so much of the city was destroyed, not just in the earthquake, but really in the fires that burned 3 days afterward, that we had to do a lot of guessing. I mean, like when you look at Chinatown today, it looks nothing like the way it would have looked pre-earthquake. And, you know, that was a big part, actually, of Janie's author's note. And one of the things that we found fascinating was, you know, Chinatown in particular, how it changed.
While reading, it's so seamless that I could not tell that there's two different authors. Like, if I didn't know that your names were on the covers, I wouldn't have known, because it just goes so fluidly. And I'm hoping that you guys write together again, because I really, really enjoyed The Phoenix Crown. But I would love to learn a little bit about that collaborative writing process and the editing process and how you made it feel so consistent. And I'll start with Janie.
We have one word: spreadsheets.
We are big bloopers in Google Spreadsheets and Google Docs.
See, normally when you write a book, you can kind of wander around. You put together a synopsis. Your agent says, yes, I'll pitch it to your publisher. Your publisher says, yeah, this looks okay. Go ahead. And you write, and you may change things as you go along and decide that you don't want your heroine doing this or that. We knew that would not work. Not if we were going to hit our deadlines, and not if we were going to stay friends. That was actually our big goal. We wanted to write a wonderful story that everyone could enjoy reading, but we also wanted to be friends after it was all over. So we actually got together like three times in person to do some plotting, like overview and then detailed plotting and then even more detailed plotting. So every row of a spreadsheet was a different chapter of the novel. We alternated between Gemma's point of view and Su Ling's point of view. And the main thing was that we each knew where the other's chapters, the action, would begin and end so that we could dovetail it seamlessly, as you say. But, you know, it was still so much fun because even though we knew in broad strokes what the other person would be writing, it would be like, I'm going to upload my chapter and I can't wait to see what Kate's going to write about hers, you know, because there's still so much room to play within an outline of a chapter. And that's what we got through.
Well, and it was also a thing too, we really discussed at the beginning. I've done some collaborative writing before, so I know a little bit where some of the pitfalls can be. And so I wanted to make sure, like from the beginning, we understood there are things like, if I am reading your chapter, is it okay if I put comment bubbles in the side? Can I put a note directly in there? But I'm not going to change your words directly, you know, because those are your words. And though I want to make sure that you're totally good with any change that I suggest. And when we have our characters, you know, since Janie wrote Su Ling and I wrote Gemma, it was a matter of every time I had Su Ling saying something or doing something in a scene that I wrote, sometimes I might just put something in brackets to say, could she say something along these lines here? And you could fill in a line of dialogue that sounds like her. Because, you know, Janie knows Su Ling's head better than I do. Or if I did make a stab at it, I would leave a note saying, feel free to change this up to be more consistent with her voice. Because I wanted to make sure that the voices of the characters were, you know, flowed from, you know, regardless of who was writing the scene. And what it comes down to really, I think, is you having a tremendous amount of respect for the other person's writing and work, which we already did because we've been friends and admirers of each other's work for years before this. And the other thing that I think we really had going for us was the fact that we had met when we were on a book tour with a third author, our lovely friend, Jennifer Robson, who's also Canadian. And that was the book tour where everything went wrong that could possibly go wrong. And I figured that if we were on a road trip with that many disasters in it and we were all still friends at the end of it, the chances that we could write a book together and still be friends at the end of it were honestly pretty good. And so it proved to be.
And I love that you've also set this in a natural disaster as well.
Jamie mentioned that she wished she had paid more attention to Chinese history when she was younger. So my question is kind of to Kate here. Were you a big history lover?
Yes, very much. I was lucky enough to have a mom who was not only a librarian, but who had a degree in ancient and medieval history. So I was hearing about history, just tidbits of it, you know, from a very young age. And that's kind of naturally where my interest gravitated as soon as I was writing stories of my own, which was also at a very young age. So that's just sort of where I gravitated very young. And I just happened to stay there.
So knowing that you came into the history love a little bit late, Janie, what compelled you to start writing historical fiction?
Well, the thing is, I've always loved historical fiction, probably because I had a neighbor whose mom borrowed a lot of historical fiction and science fiction books. And to this day, those are my two favorite genres. And Kate is a sci-fi geek as well. So that's the other reason we get along. But honestly, when I first started writing, it was because of my grandmother. Her life was very unusual in that she did try to rebel against family expectations, but she did not succeed. And so I wrote a story around that. And then the next book that I wrote was also set in China, because my father had told me so many stories about family history. It was just the easiest thing for me to gravitate to. And I swear, back then, I was so naive. I did not even realize I was writing historical fiction. Okay. But now it's so interesting for me, because I feel that with historical fiction, you can make a lot of comments about things that are going on in our world right now, but it's through a different lens.
That's actually always been something I've thought. And I think it's another reason why Janie and I are both big sci-fi fans, as well as historical fans. They're in a way kind of sister genres, I think, because both of them are examining the issues of the present through a different lens. The historical fiction uses the lens of the past. We're quite often looking at, you know, problems that we are still struggling with today, but we're looking at them as people have handled them in the past. For sci-fi, they're looking at the problems of the present through the lens of the future. But for both of those, it's looking at something with a slightly different world, and the world building is key, whether you're trying to create a past world that did exist or a future world that might exist. So I think that's one of the reasons why we both love not only historical fiction, but sci-fi.
And that kind of gets into a question that we were going to get to earlier, but seeing how you segue so nicely into it, when you're writing through these historical lenses and you kind of get, I mean, we're all familiar with the phrase about how history repeats itself, and you get to see how, you know, the various, while there might be a new flavor to what it is, you do get to see how that history repeats itself, and trying to find hope in those past tragedies to kind of gear toward breaking those cycles. Is that more or less kind of what you're explaining to me, I guess?
I would say yes. And Stephen, for me, I think it hit me a little strongly, because my characters being Chinese women, not only is there sort of the past of patriarchal societies, but like Chinese society was extremely constricting towards women. And sometimes, like I've heard, this has not been addressed to me, but someone asked another author, well, you know, I really wish you'd made your character more of a feminist. And I felt like saying, excuse me, you know, it's the 17th century. She has bound feet that are 3 inches long. She's not been allowed to, you know, learn how to read and write. The only influence she has, you know, are the women within the courtyard. I think she's done pretty darn well, you know, because 21st century feminism is not the same as 17th or 18th century feminism. And so the challenge, again, is to find ways for your female character to break out, to try and be different, but to keep it plausible.
And it's making me think even 1970s second wave feminism and 90s third wave feminism are totally different ways of thinking of what is feminism. I'm going to totally go into a different direction. The Phoenix Crown starts with the timeline ticking down to the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. It has almost like a thriller quality to the plot. So much is happening at the time. And throughout the novel, you keep up that pacing. As a reader, I couldn't put the book down. So how do you keep up that quick pacing as an author? And I'll start with Kate.
That really came down to the spreadsheet again and some very careful plotting. We sort of decided we kind of wanted that ticking clock right from the beginning. And we know, you know, thanks to very meticulous data, exactly when the earthquake happened. It was at, you know, 5:12 in the morning of, you know, April 18th and 1906. And I really hope I just didn't get the date wrong and get egg all over my sights. I'm pretty sure it's the 18th. Believe me, it's like a year since we did the research on this. And probably already the dates are flying out of my head since I've had to do other research since then. But we wanted that ticking clock. Therefore, we thought from the beginning, like, all right, we have the earthquake here. The opera is the night before. What happens at each point before? And what day does that happen? And then we counted it from, we knew that, you know, Gemma, who was the new arrival to the city, that meant what day is she going to arrive? And then we decided we wanted things to happen on as tight a timeline as we could. So we kind of walked it back to, let's have her arrive about 2 weeks before and we'll have everything happen in those 2 weeks that run to the earthquake. And then that meant that we had to track some things back further from that. You know, when did so-and-so meet? When was, you know, Su Ling orphaned? When did she meet her lover, Reggie? You know, when, because these things all happen before the book really even begins and they have to be meticulously plotted in the backstory. So we made sure to do that in part because it, you know, kept that propulsive quality to the plot, but also it helped us again with the writing because when we had we're writing our alternating chapters, it meant that for every chapter, we knew exactly how much time passes in this chapter and what events are supposed to happen in it. So that way we can keep to that timeline and make sure that our characters arrive to the earthquake on schedule.
And, you know, every so often, Kate would say, you know, I don't think the stakes are high enough here. What can we do? What can we do to make the situation even more dire, you know? So for me, it was like, okay, the timeline for the arranged marriage is moving up. Okay, they discover what's happened to her lover, and you know, and what does that mean?
It really made it to her. I couldn't stop reading. I was like, okay, next, what's happening next?
Well, very good. It means we did our job.
You mentioned you were both sci-fi lovers. Is there a genre that either of you haven't written that you want to dabble more in? And we can start with Janie.
Well, I don't dare write sci-fi because, I mean, people out there who do, they have so much imagination. So I haven't thought about it. For my first three novels, however, I have incorporated elements of fantasy, bringing in a lot of Chinese folklore and mythology. So again, you know, it's not so much magical realism as using supernatural elements that are actually consistent with Chinese folklore and what my characters would recognize. You know, if they run into a fox spirit, they would understand what that is. So I guess I've played around with a bit of fantasy, but I do like fantasy that happens in the past or pertains to the past, is modeled on the past. Kate and I are hoping to have coffee with Guy Gavriel Kay when we get to Toronto next month, because we are like a big admirer of his fantasy / historical novels. And that's the stuff that I really love. So I think I would gravitate towards something like that rather than sci-fi.
I think probably the same would go for me too. I've dabbled a little bit with a fantastic element in a book or two, actually just more what I have coming up than what I have already had. I've had a little bit of a fantasy element in my next book, The Briar Club, which is coming out this July. That's my next solo book. And I've even did a little bit with sci-fi because I did a short story with Amazon Originals called Signal Moon. And that actually involved a sort of a time travel, time switch element where it was the crossing of timelines between modern day and a World War II timeline. And I had a lot of fun with that. So I do like to play with a little of the sci-fi fantasy genre in there here and there. I prefer to still keep things grounded in historical, but yeah, who knows? It is a fun place to play.
I mean, it's
totally forgot. I am so sorry. I feel like such a ditz right now without my coffee, but I am currently writing a Gothic novel set in pre-war Shanghai. So, you know, it's historical, but I'm using the Gothic genre. So.
I love the Gothic genre. So I'm going to have to add that to my list. A haunted house or Something spooky. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, it's called The Fourth Princess. And I'm just, you know, going into a slow meltdown right now because I need to hand it in by the end of this month.
All right. So when I was doing my own like rabbit hole research, I had to pull up a Phoenix crown to see what it looked like. And I was just blown away by the details of the kingfisher feathers. And I don't even know how the craftsman would have. I mean, it looks like gemstones. It's stunning. So were either of you able to see an example of a Phoenix crown in person? Or how did you decide on the Phoenix crown to be kind of this, you know, center point in the plot?
I don't know. I think it may have been Kate that brought it up, because we were looking at the fact that this robber baron was collecting incredible Chinese antiquities.
It was one of those things where it's like we were looking at the time period and like this whole fashion for Orientalism and chinoiserie among the rich, and the fact that, you know, the city had been looted in China, you know, not that long ago, only a handful of years ago. So we're talking like this is major, major art theft going on, and, you know, just wholesale looting that happened from the Europeans in China. And so all this stuff is making its way into the West. And I think just the word, we were kind of thinking, well, he'll be a collector. You know, we can put in some fabulous Chinese collection that he has. And we just came across the words Phoenix Crown. And I just remember looking at that and saying, wouldn't that make a good title? And like, it was like right from there, we thought, oh, yeah, I think that's it. I was thinking originally because, you know, phoenixes in the Western tradition are like these, you know, flaming things that are, you know, orange and gold and red, but that's not at all what a phoenix crown is in when you look at it in the Chinese lore.
And, you know, your reaction, Sarah, is exactly what we'd hoped for, to be so fascinated by this bit of, you know, jewelry making that is practically unknown in the West. I mean, I have seen pieces, and actually I bought some vintage, like they're just hairpins made from kingfisher feathers, which I hope to take on the book tour with us as show and tell items. But to have an entire crown, that really was worthy of an empress. We were trying to find one at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, but it was not on display, even though we were sweet talking one of the guys there as hard as we could. Can we go back into your archives and take a look?
No, they did not. But yeah, it's the way that a phoenix crown is, you know, made. There are jewels, there are pearls, you know, rubies and gold and all that, but it comes down to kingfisher feathers. And kingfisher feathers are very carefully cut and then, you know, glued, you know, with, I think, into glass or, you know, gold or silver wires. And that is what gives the crown this vibrant, incredible, iridescent blue color. And it never is going to fade because it's not a dye. It's not a pigment or a paint. It's a feather. It's an optical illusion. So the color won't fade. And it's one of those things we actually found really interesting, you know, because it was so expensive. It was, you know, kingfisher feather jewelry was limited to, was, you know, very, very expensive. And a crown like this really would have been worn by an empress or, you know, someone in the royal family. But it was the fact that the Chinese government actually outlawed the making of kingfisher feather jewelry, I think in the 1940s, Jenny, you said, because of the conservation effort, because it was killing the kingfishers.
Mm-hmm. If that makes sense with, I think the 1940s was the Migratory Bird Act, but I could not, maybe not. Maybe that was a little later.
Well, the thing is, now they are reviving that craft because the craft died, wow. Right? I mean, yeah. During the, you know, with the communist revolution and everything, and stuff to do with royalty was very much frowned upon. But so the artisans that are doing it now, they're dyeing goose feathers to do the same thing, or they are using feathers from bird sanctuaries, like the naturally shed feathers. You can still get for like reasonable hundreds of dollars, just hairpins and things like that.
You know, so you can imagine the conversations that were had with our spouses where we were explaining that for research purposes, we would have to be buying some antique kingfisher feather hairpins, you know, for our personal collections. And that went well, but actually it did go well. It went in our favor. We each now have at least one.
I love it.
It's a business expense.
Absolutely.
It's a business expense.
Well, we try to have a little bit of fun with our interview process. We normally play a game that we call Kiss, Marry, Ditch. You might have noted it somewhere else, but because we're doing this in a new format where we have two of you here, we're going to make a game show kind of thing where I'm going to ask about six questions and I want you both just to shout out your answers. Whoever shouts it out first is going to get a point here, but these are going to be dealing with time travel. So here we go.
All right.
We're traveling back to 1906. What modern invention would you take with you?
Deodorant. Or I don't know. I'm thinking vaccines.
I'm thinking vaccines, but you know, what? Which ones? There's so many. There's so many.
Taking out the time frame here, it's now on you. What year are we traveling back to?
Oh, I think the 1920s would be good.
Renaissance Italy. I'd love to see Renaissance Italy.
If you could go anywhere in the world tomorrow, where would it be?
Ravenna, Italy.
Venice.
Is there a time period you most enjoy writing about?
Turn of the 20th century. There was so much turmoil. And fiction requires turmoil.
Amen.
Favorite book or movie that involves time travel?
Oh,
I vapor locked immediately. I suddenly have no memory of anything I have ever read that involves time travel. This always happens when I'm asked to come up with book titles.
What time travel? Do I have any time? I'm looking at my book collection thinking, do I have any time travel stories?
Well, anytime you look at time travel, you have to make a bow toward the mistress of time travel, which is Diana Gabaldon in Outlander. At the very least, we give the bow to her.
Right. We'll go with that. I'm still staring at my bookshelf.
So final question here. If we're going to make this time travel work, what are the rules that we have to obey?
Oh, cannot change anything that might change history and therefore the future. That's like...
I think that's time travel 101. No playing with the timeline. Or else like some kind of time cop is going to come get you. That's pretty universal.
Time agent. Yeah.
I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to make that time cop work for his thing because I'm changing everything I can.
The alternate histories. Well, in titling it, I think Janie won in terms of answering the fastest. So she is our light speed time traveler. And even when trying to come up with this, I was thinking of the Outlander soundtrack as like, if we had a bigger budget, we would have that play. So just picture that there, the Skyboat song and the new lyrics of that.
Excellent.
So writing tends to be solitary in nature. Obviously, in this case, you had a collaborator here. But when you're looking at this and you're working as a team, at what point do you kind of... put yourself out there, and this can even be just as individually, because you're both successful writers in your own right. At what point do you look at a story and say, this is it, it has to have somebody else's eyes on it, and you have to let go and let the bird fly?
I think that with every chapter, we were more careful, because normally when you write on your own, it can be as raw as you want. But for me, knowing that once I uploaded it to Google Docs, Kate would be reading it, like not just anybody, but another author would be reading it. It was like, okay, I need to go over this and polish it a little bit more. So there's that. But you know, Kate, we also had beta readers. So that's one of the wonderful things about the writing community.
If I'm just doing my own books, nobody tends to read my rough drafts until I'm at least I have a messy first draft. And then, you know, I do have beta readers who read for me, and I'm a big believer in them. They're wonderful fellow historical fiction novelists. And I really rely on that. And we actually had a couple of them read Phoenix Crown for us once we were done. But it is true that like for this one, for this process, you're showing your writing to a colleague much sooner than you normally would be. Normally speaking, I would have a chance to finish a whole draft before I show it to anybody else and do a little polishing on the way. And this was pretty much like as soon as we had a chapter done and maybe gave it a cursory polish, it was up on the shared Google Drive so the other person could have it and use that to go onward. And that was a little nerve-wracking to start because I, at least speaking for myself, it's like I would far rather, you know, be seen in my underwear by you know, a colleague than, you know, have a colleague I respect see my messy, you know, horrible rough draft. You know, it is a feeling naked experience. Although it got better as time went on because we were so involved in the story that there was a real feeling of excitement, kind of like we're standing on opposite sides of a fence, so like throwing parts of the story back and forth. So at some point you're like, you were so eager to know what the other person would do with it that, you know, it's like, all right, I'm just throwing it up there. It's a mess, but have a look at it. You know, so that was, it got easier as time went on. But to start with, I was kind of sitting there going like, all right, yeah. I'm putting it up. Be nice.
And we are, and you know, we're both experienced enough to know that the chapters we were throwing up there at some point in the future, we were going to like meld it all into one big document and see if it all made sense. And we would still have opportunities to do revisions, which, you know, it became less nerve-wracking the closer yeah. we got to having a completed story that we knew we could, you know, read, you know, nose to tail.
So how many moments in your writing when you were both kind of like, oh my goodness, this little piece of history would weave perfectly into the story, like seeing a picture of Alice Eastwood and her hat with the flowers and then making the leap that Su Ling would have made those flowers?
Oh, goodness. You know what? We went into those stately mansions thinking we're going to see all these wonderful, you know, these ballrooms, these crystal chandeliers and everything. But I'm telling you, it was the backstage stuff that really got us. It was the servant staircase. It was the servant corridors. It was, well, that wonderful wardrobe where the mistress of the house got to stand in there with the revolving shoe racks. Those little things really, they found their way into the story.
Of course, there's always the things that don't make it into the story. And yes. we did mourn, you know, in our history geek hearts that there were things that we did not have enough room for. There's a one-line mention, two lines maybe, of Donaldina Cameron, who ran the mission home in Chinatown and was a woman who not only, you know, made a very plausible way in which, you know, Su Ling could speak such good English and, you know, have obtained her education, but also she was a real woman who was notorious for rescuing young women from sexual servitude or indentured service. And she would literally storm into these places and like drag these, you know, girls who have been trafficked out of cribs and, you know, take them back to the mission and, you know, nurse them back to health and make sure that they, you know, protect them from the men who were exploiting them and get them set on new lives. And, you know, she would have been really interesting to write more about, but we did not have room for her in the story. So there's a case of something that you kind of was on the cutting room floor. We're sorry we did not have room for it.
How do you spend your time when you're not writing? How do you recharge?
Lots of fun TV. I read a lot on my own. There's wine, there's baseball when it's in season. I'm a big Red Sox fan, and I have three adorable rescue dogs who do not care about my deadline and still need to be walked and otherwise cuddled and petted and made to feel important. They are very important. I could not write anything without them.
Like Kate, I love to read. And unfortunately, when writing, we end up reading more nonfiction for research. And I do not get to read as much for pleasure as I'd like. So I try and make a dent in the TBR stack between books. We moved into a new place last year. So there's a lot of gardening, maintenance, fix-up to do. And I love gardening, even though I am terrible at it. And we have to remove a lot of blackberry before we can do any planting. And as my husband pointed out as I was ripping out blackberry earlier this summer, well, at least you're intending to kill these. And my husband and I love to travel. We have a thing about, we like collecting Cistercian monasteries. We like going to places where they have, you know, the ruins or working Cistercian monasteries. So, yeah.
And you both mentioned you love reading. I saw that Kate had read 146 books on her Goodreads. And then Janie, you have your own magical library in this new home that you've been working on, complete with the ladder. It's a Beauty and the Beast style, even though I guess they said don't actually use it like Beauty and the Beast spells with the sliding. But what are you both currently reading? And I'll start with Kate.
Well, right now I'm reading Guy Gabriel Kay's Tigana, which is a fabulous fantasy book. And I was a little bit inspired by the fact that I get to have coffee with him when Janie and I are on tour when we are in Canada. So that'll be fun. And I just finished a fabulous read for a cover quote. It was an ARC called The Secret Keeper of Main Street by Tricia Thomas. And that I really enjoyed. And I did give the quote to. It's about a young black dressmaker in the 1950s in an Oklahoma oil town. And it's about the fact that she has the ability not only to dress brides, but get a little image of what their future with marriage might look like, which makes her highly in demand until the day that a very unhappy bride with violence in her wake comes into the shop. And that was really a fun read. And I'm looking forward to seeing it hit shelves, and other readers love it too.
Well, I like to read somewhat out of the genre when I'm writing. So I just finished a book, a crime thriller by Robert Dugoni, and it's called Her Deadly Game. And what's interesting is that it's kind of like a cross between a thriller and The Queen's Gambit, because the detective is a young woman and she's playing a chess game as she's also trying to strategize how to figure out, you know, who done it. She's actually a lawyer for the defense, and she's trying to figure out who really done it, not her client. That was really interesting, having that parallel. And I just started on a book by a Canadian author, Roberta Rich, and it's called The Jazz Club Spy. And it begins with a young girl whose Jewish village is being demolished by the Cossacks, and she's hiding inside the carcass of their family cow who's been slaughtered. And she can see her family being killed. And then the story moves to Jazz Age New York City, where she recognizes some faces from her past. So that is historical. I could not resist the premise.
One of the things we like to ask here, because it kind of gives us a glimpse into what may be coming on the horizon, what is the strangest thing in your search histories?
Oh, goodness. A writer's search history is always a very scary place. I think one of the ones that might be seen as the most alarming from when I was writing The Diamond Eye, which was my last solo release, was I literally was Googling whether a certain creek in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. was deep enough to sink a body in.
I finally committed that trope of novelists everywhere. I was Googling poisons.
We all have the poison search.
If it makes you feel any better, and I'm not even writing anything, I was Googling whether or not you could hide a body in La Brea Tar Pit the other day for, I don't even remember why I got on that trick.
Steven. Now I'm curious. And we are a library podcast. So how have libraries impacted your life? And I'll start with Janie.
I was one of those nerdy kids who ate lunch in the library, and you were not supposed to bring food or drink into the school library, but the librarian recognized and nurtured our nerdiness. So there was a small group of us. We sat in the back corner and we read and we talked in whispers. Libraries have always been a sanctuary for me. And at some point you read so much that you think, gosh, I'd like to be one of these people that creates books. It honestly never occurred to me for the longest time until one of my teachers said, oh, you know, this is a very nice little essay that you wrote. You could write a book one day. And you think, I could write a book? Oh my goodness, there's people behind those words.
Well, I really grew up in libraries because my mother was a librarian, which meant that I just was literally running around libraries as a kid from a very young age and, you know, running up massive library finds because I was always late with books and taking out these huge stacks, which always got this comments from adults and they're like, you really going to read all those? And I never know what the appropriate response to that is. It's like, no, I need doorstops at home. That's what I'm going to do with them. Yes, I'm going to read them all probably by tomorrow. But that was me growing up. I was, again, the bookworm kid. And, you know, I was very lucky that not only did I grow up around libraries, my parents read to me. They didn't teach. I didn't learn to read, you know, especially young, you know, only, you know, kindergarten, same as, or first grade, same as anybody. But my parents read to me young. So I learned to love stories before I could even read. And then once I learned to read, my parents joked that I pretty much never moved again, like through my childhood. Mm-hmm. Like if I had a book, like you could plant me somewhere, I would still be there as long as the book lasted. You could probably check in 2 days later and I'd still be there if it was a long book. So that was me growing up. And I really do feel very grateful for libraries and librarians and books just for launching me into all of this.
Although, you know, I kind of wish that my school librarian had told me at age 11 that Wuthering Heights was probably not a good book to read as a model for sustainable romantic relationships. Because, you know, these things make a big impression on you at that age.
I still remember a woman humorist I liked who said, reading Wuthering Heights has destroyed more women than the cholera.
It's still on my reading list. I haven't read it yet, but my grandmother loves it. And all of her cats have been named Heathcliff or some character from Wuthering Heights.
So as we kind of wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, just thank you so much for having us and for letting us, you know, yatter for so long about our book. And we hope that you will enjoy it.
Same here. Love being on this show. You guys are so much fun.
Thank you. It's been such a fun interview. I've just been waiting for this interview. So thank you again. And the Phoenix Crown, everyone needs to pick up a copy. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's a fast read too. So if you're like, oh, I don't have time, you have time for this one. Squeeze it in.
You heard her. Obey the librarian. Thank you guys so much. This was such a fun one to do.
Thank you. It has been our pleasure. I assure you the fun has been more on our end than your end.
Well, thank you guys so much for reading and for inviting us.
Thank you so much, Kate and Janie, for joining us on Unstacked. The Phoenix Crown will be available in the library collection for checkout.
It can also be purchased through your favorite bookstore and online vendors. Check out their websites, katequinnauthor.com, that's KateQuinnAuthor.com, and Janie Chang. JanieChang.com.
Stay safe and read, my friend. It's good for you. Bye.
Bye.